Okay, so I've spent sort of an extended introduction on some aspects of quantum field theory, and sort of maybe hopefully tried to give you a bit of an intuitive feeling for how we think about effective field theories, quantum field theories from the point of view of effective field theories. And I'm now going to transition to start talking about some of the more popular examples, some of the more popular proposals for new physics beyond the Standard Model. And the one I'm going to start off with supersymmetry. This is the one that's probably received the most attention. There are various reasons for this. Some of it's aesthetic. Some of it because it turns out that if you extend the Standard Model of supersymmetry, you can calculate stuff in a nice way. This isn't always the case with some extensions of the Standard Model. And what you get out of supersymmetry is, I'll get to this in a bit more detail, but for every particle that we know, it implies that there exists a superpartner particle. And the superpartner has essentially the same properties as your particle, but its spin differs by half a unit. So for example, if my spin 1/2 fermions in the Standard Model, those will turn out to connect to spin 0 scalar superpartners. And the vector bosons of the Standard Model will turn out to connect to spin 1/2 fermion superpartners. And the big motivation, at least from the phenomenological side, the big motivation for supersymmetry appearing near the weak scale is the hierarchy problem. So I spent a fair bit of time on the hierarchy problem over the past few days, and I guess you also heard about it in the Standard Model class. And what supersymmetry does is essentially ensures a cancellation between particles and superpartners. So recall that we had this potential for the Higgs. And that when we calculated the effects either of divergent quantum corrections or of the effects of integrating out heavy particles, we found large corrections to this mu squared parameter. And typically, the correction to mu squared parameter, in the case of divergent pieces, would be proportional to the cutoff. In the case of integrating out heavy states and keeping only the finite terms, after renormalizing away the would-be infinities, we see that the corrections to mu squared go like the mass of the heavy particle you're integrating out. What happens with supersymmetry is there are now two contributions to delta mu squared. And these go roughly like, suppose my new particles are psi and some superpartner of psi that I'll call psi tilde. And suppose they have some coupling y psi to the Higgs. The corrections to mu squared turn out to go like y psi over 4 pi squared. With a difference of the masses of these heavy states you're integrating out. So this is a particle superpartner pair. It's going to turn out that supersymmetry is going to force upon us the same effective coupling for both the particle and the superpartner to the Higgs. And therefore, you get the same coupling here. And the only difference is that the superpartner mass can be slightly different from the particle mass. And to the extent that these masses are similar, you get a cancellation to the correction to delta mu squared. So if I think about particles near the weak scale, actually they don't even have to be near the weak scale. If we think about the size of this correction for it to make sense in terms of the hierarchy, we want it to be smaller than roughly the size of mu squared that we observe, which is about 100 GeV squared. So that means that this combination should be roughly less than about 100 GeV squared. And it's going to turn out that this mass splitting is going to correspond roughly to the amount by which supersymmetry is not an exact symmetry. So it will also turn out that in the limit of exact supersymmetry, the particle and its superpartner would have exactly the same mass. We don't observe that. So we know that we see electrons at half an MeV, but we don't see scalar electron superpartners that have half an MeV. So supersymmetry can't be an exact symmetry, but it can still be an approximate symmetry. And if it's an approximate symmetry such that the mass splitting between particles and superpartners isn't too big, this cancellation will be sufficiently small. But one of the implications of this is, since this mass splitting corresponds to the amount by which supersymmetry isn't exact, this mass splitting is also going to coincide with the expected mass of superpartners. So here I have a mass splitting that should set roughly the standard model superpartner mass scale times a loop factor. And depending on what I put in here, this loop factor is typically order 10 to the minus 2, 10 to the minus 3. So I put that in here, I put that in here, and that suggests that with supersymmetry, as long as supersymmetry is fairly is a reasonable approximate symmetry, I expect my superpartner masses to be on the order of about a TeV, about 1,000 GeV. So the exciting part about that is that supersymmetry, as motivated by the hierarchy problem, suggests that we should be able to see new particles at the LHC. Yes. Yes. Of each other.
And the, so psi is the boson unpsi tilde is the fermion, or some?
Yes, yeah, so I have my psi being the fermion and psi tilde being the boson, but up to a sign, you get the same result. And the sign sort of doesn't matter. You still have to build 100 GeV. So. Okay. Now, supersymmetry also gives some other nice properties. One of them is that with a very slight extension of the minimal supersymmetric application of the standard model, you get a very natural dark matter candidate that is supersymmetrizing the standard model. And one further thing that I won't spend much time on, but I guess you covered a bit of a normalization group in the standard model course. So there's this idea that the effective couplings in your theory depend on the energy at which you measure them. And if I look at the standard model, the standard model has three gauge couplings. I have the strong gauge coupling, I have the SU2 gauge coupling, and I have the hypercharge gauge coupling. So I'll call these G1, G2, and G3. We know the strong coupling at low energies. Let's say I call this a low energy scale. Let's say I take it to be the Z mass. So I can measure these couplings at low energies, and we know that the strong coupling is stronger than the SU2 coupling, stronger than the U1 coupling. But I can take these couplings and I can extrapolate them up in energy using the renormalization group. And when I do that, when I do that within the standard model, what I find is, well, we know for one that the strong coupling becomes smaller. The SU2 coupling, I think it grows slightly. And this U1 coupling also grows. Actually, it has to grow. And the U1 coupling does something like this. So these gauge couplings, as I extrapolate them up in energy, start to come together. But they don't quite come together at a point. What happens if I take the if I take the standard model and I apply supersymmetry, I get a slightly different renormalization group evolution. Instead of this, what I get instead is a slightly different trajectory because the superpartners come in and change the running of these couplings. And what I get with supersymmetry looks something like this. And the neat thing about the supersymmetric story is that these couplings turn out to come together at a point, all three of them, to within error bars in a really suggestive way. And one of the potential interpretations of this So they sort of come together in the standard model, but not quite exactly. They come together in a really, really nice way with supersymmetry. And so, okay, so this is the gauge coupling, and this is the energy. And it turns out that this energy is something we usually call mgut, and it's about 10 to the 16 GeV. So this is like 100 GeV. And the interpretation of this, or at least a possible interpretation that's consistent with the matching of the gauge couplings, is that our standard model gauge group involves three gauge factors, SU3 cross SU2 cross U1y. One possibility is that these all come from a unified subgroup. So SU5 is the minimal case. You could also have bigger groups like SO10, E6, or on and on. And first of all, the fact that these gauge couplings come together is suggestive of this kind of unification. So what you would expect in this case is, suppose I start off with SU5 at a very high energy. If I had SU5 at a very high energy, let's say over here, I might have, let's say, a full SU5 symmetry, in which case there's only one gauge coupling to talk about. But I could have some kind of Higgs mechanism, or Higgs-like mechanism, that splits the SU5 into this 3-2-1 subgroup. And the splitting into a 3-2-1 subgroup is analogous to the regular Higgs mechanism that takes this bigger SU2 cross U1 group, and it breaks it down to a U1 of electromagnetism. So similar to that electroweak symmetry breaking that you saw in the standard model, you can have you can have a spontaneous gauge symmetry breaking of one of these unified groups, these so-called unified groups, SU5 or SO10 or E6 or on and on. And what you would expect in that case is that at the breaking scale, you start off with equal couplings. And then as you extrapolate them down, because you no longer have the full SU5 symmetry, they run differently, and you see these different couplings today. Yeah.
Presumably, the grand unified group has more particles than what we see in the standard model.
Yes.
Or the supersymmetry extension.
Yes.
So wouldn't they affect the running of the coupling?
Yeah. So the picture with SU5, with or without supersymmetry, is that the stuff in the standard model comes from comes in various representations of SU5. And in principle, you can have other matter. But the implicit assumption is that other matter is very heavy, and you integrate it out at this so-called grand unification scale. So okay, I should say that this is called grand unification. And just two more things that are kind of hint that this kind of unification could happen. Is remember that in the standard model, your gauge representations written in terms of left-handed fermions are like so. And it turns out that these representations, I have one for each generation, these representations turn out to fit very nicely into representations of SU5 or SO10. So for example, representations of SU5 you usually hear about are the 5, so just the fundamental representation. And it turns out that the 5 of SU5, the quantum numbers of this representation with this subgroup, SU3 cross SU2 cross U1, match up very well. So I hope I get this right. I think it's LDC. And the 10 has all the right quantum numbers to embed a Q, UC, EC. So the standard model representations also turn out to fit very nicely within within representations, in this case, of SU5. And let me just make sure the numbers are right. So here I have essentially two fermions. This is an SU2 doublet. And here I have an SU3 triplet, SU2 singlet. So that gives me 5. This guy has 3 times 2, 6, plus 3, plus 1. So that's 10, that's 5, and the numbers work out. And there's also an SO10 embedding. And the SO10 embedding is in a 16-dimensional representation. And the 16-dimensional representation is QUC, DC, L, EC, N. And this n is a pure gauge singlet under the SU3 cross SU2 cross U1. But this is precisely the thing that is often invoked to generate neutrino masses. So did you cover neutrino masses in the standard model for us a little bit? So there's this very nice picture of, first of all, with supersymmetry, the gauge couplings unify very nicely at a high energy, roughly 10 to the 16 GeV. And it also turns out that the standard model matter multiplets fit very nicely into these irreducible representations of these potential unified groups. Yes? I forget the details on that, so I'm not going to be able to say anything. Okay, but anyway, so these are the simplest embeddings. There are fancier ones as well, but yes, yeah.
Is this unification of gauge couplings unique to supersymmetry, or is it unique to a specific model?
Your expectation from unification, at least in simple unification models, are that at some high scale, all your couplings should start at a single equal point. And in principle, I could embed just the standard model within a unified group. But the problem is the couplings don't quite come together. Now, turn.
Without supersymmetry.
So the couplings don't quite come together. So just the standard model doesn't quite look to be consistent with unification on its own. But what you can do in the standard model is add extra multiplets. And you could add extra multiplets that change the running such that all the couplings do come together. The problem with that, though, is when you add those multiplets, you have to add them in multiplets that are not complete gut multiplets. And that means that the embedding is more complicated, and you don't have this nice matching up. So what you get is supersymmetry. So supersymmetry and unification are two completely independent things. But we just so happen to have the apparent accident that the standard model with supersymmetry does give you this beautiful unification of couplings. So there's a nice consistent picture where I have unification plus supersymmetry. The couplings all come together very nicely. My multiplets all match up very nicely into complete irreducible representations of the gut groups. And this doesn't mean the unification happens, and it doesn't mean the supersymmetry is there. But it is a nice self-consistent picture that does hint at this deeper structure. So I've heard some people call this evidence for supersymmetry. I think that's much too strong. But at least it is a very suggestive picture that I'd say could at least hint at this deeper structure. Yes?
Do you remember what the Higgs sector is like in SU5 unification?
I did pull a bit of a fast one that you pointed out. So the Higgs is, the Higgs's and supersymmetry, it turns out, don't fit into complete gut multiplets. And one of the challenges of writing down grand unified theories is figuring out how to embed those Higgs multiplets within gut multiplets, and then split those multiplets at the grand unification scale. And what I mean by split the multiplet is that in such a unified theory, everything would have to come from a complete grand unified multiplet. But by splitting the multiplet, you take some elements of the multiplet and make them heavy, and others and make them light. Now, you already have to do that with these gauge factors. So it turns out that, remember that the vector bosons corresponding to a gauge symmetry always transform in the adjoint. And it turns out the adjoint of SU5 is 24-dimensional, whereas the adjoints here are 8, 3, and 1. So it turns out you already have to split the elements of the vector multiplet. And for this picture to work, you would also have to do the same for the Higgs multiplets. And that can be a little bit non-trivial. Okay. So anyway, this is a bit of an aside, but it is kind of a fun aside. And there's a lot of work on gauge unification. Again, we don't know if it's true or correct. One really interesting hint of it, and I think you'll cover this actually in the tutorial, is that because these multiplets, these gut multiplets, combine leptons and baryons, they necessarily violate baryon and lepton number. And because of that, in the grand unified theories, you expect baryon and lepton number violation. And for example, in this kind of theory, you can get operators generated from integrating out the heavy gut multiplets, especially the vector stuff, that go like 1 over m gut squared qqql. So you can show that this is a gauge invariant combination of things. Here, the three quark multiplets are contracted with the anti-symmetric tensor, epsilon ijk. And then the doublets are contracted with epsilon aps on their SE2 indices. In any case, this is a gauge invariant operator that you would typically expect to be generated from integrating out some of the heavy states from the gut multiplet. And this operator, as you look at today, can generate proton decay. So a potential signature of grand unification is baryon and lepton number violation in the form of proton decay. So there are certain experiments looking for proton decay. Typically, they take really, really big vats of water, put them deep underground to shield them from cosmic rays, and look for a flash of light for essentially no good reason other than a proton decay. And from this, they've been able to put limits on the lifetime of the proton of about 10 to the 33 years. And you can translate this into limits on the gut scale and consistency with these unified theories. OK, anyway, this is a bit of an aside. Let me get back to supersymmetry specifically. And supersymmetry, it turns out, can be thought of as an extension of the Poincaré symmetries of flat spacetime. So if you recall the Poincaré group is translations plus Lorentz. And the translations have some generators p mu that you can identify with energy and momentum generators. And Lorentz has generators j mu nu. And j mu nu is anti-symmetric. So it's a two-index anti-symmetric tensor. The indices run from 0 to 3. And that implies that there are six independent elements, or six independent generators. And these correspond to three rotation generators and three boosts. And OK, so was this something you covered in the standard model for QFT? A little bit? Yeah. OK. So we take Poincaré. And to describe quantum fields, because we know that the Poincaré is a good symmetry, at least a flat space time, we're mostly concerned, we look for the irreducible representations of the Poincaré group. And we look at irreducible representations on fields. And that corresponds to essentially finding explicit matrices that satisfy the commutation relations for these generators of Poincaré. And what we get out of that are the various representations. So you have your scalar fields. The next representations up are two component left, so-called left and right-handed fermions. You have your vector representation, and so on and so forth. So the types of fields we see in our quantum field theories based on the underlying Poincaré invariants can be organized into these irreducible representations. And it sounds like you spent a fair bit of time on two-component fermions in the standard model course, so again, I won't say that. But these two-component fermions give you an irreducible representation of Poincaré. If you also add parity, though, these things have opposite parities. If you also demand that parity is a symmetry, you end up combining these things into a representation that is reducible under Poincaré, but is irreducible under Poincaré plus parity. And that is the Dirac fermion. And you make your four-component Dirac fermion by combining two different two-component fermions. In any case, this is the story for Poincaré and so on. Where supersymmetry comes in is it turns out that supersymmetry is an extension of this Poincaré story. So what I mean by that, so let me just find where I am in the notes. OK, so before talking about supersymmetry specifically, let me give you a little bit of history. So back in, let's say, mid-60s, people were thinking a lot about symmetries of all kinds of things. People were really gung-ho on symmetries and field theories. They're realizing just how powerful they were. And of course, we know we have these Poincaré symmetries. And a natural question to ask is whether there is any kind of extension of the Poincaré symmetries of spacetime, in the sense that if you think about the standard model, for example, has symmetries under Poincaré, but it also has symmetries under, or I should say, has gauge invariances. And generally, field theories will have either global or gauge symmetries on top of the Poincaré symmetries. But in these cases, we always see that these symmetries come in. Independently of each other. In the sense that if I do a gauge transformation or a global transformation, that is independent of the Poincaré transformations. And what people start to think about is there a more general class of transformations that doesn't just factorize into Poincaré and then kind of these, if you like, independent generators? Or put another way, the generators for these gauge and global symmetries are Lorentz scalars. And are there any consistent symmetries under which I have something like a gauge or global symmetry, but with generators that are not Lorentz scalars? And it turns out that the answer is almost no. So the question was, can we combine these in some non-trivial way? And the answer is, OK, I'll say no. Almost. And there are some assumptions that go into this. The first assumption, and this is all reasonable, so the standard assumptions are things like CPT invariance. And this seems to be a necessarily conditioned for any consistent quantum field theory. They assumed that you had to have distinguishable particles of non-zero mass. And they assumed that you necessarily had to have a non-trivial S matrix. And it turns out that when you take all those things together, it's not possible to combine Poincaré with gauge and global other than in this factorized way, or at least almost. And the almost comes in that in the original attempt, the symmetry generators that tried to combine these things were assumed to be bosonic, in the sense that, for example, like a U1 symmetry. You'll have something like a field goes to e to the I alpha psi, and the generator of this transformation alpha is in this case it's just a scalar, it's just a number, it's a boson, and the assumption in this case was that the generators of this attempted combined symmetry it wouldn't necessarily have to be Lorentz scalar, but it would have to be a bosonic, in the sense that it would have to correspond to an even spin representation of Poincaré. Now, a little bit later, some other people came along and showed that you can get around this no-go theorem in a very specific way if your generators are fermionic. So the loophole is fermionic generators. So right now I'm being very hand-wavy. I'll go back and try to make this more precise in a second. And OK, so first of all, this first result is called the Coleman-Mandula theorem. And this loophole was found by various people. Hogg, OK, and a few others. But anyway, and it turns out that the maximal loophole with these fermionic generators is something called supersymmetry. So if you like, supersymmetry is a maximal extension of Poincaré that can give you massive particles, a non-trivial S matrix, CPT invariants. And when they found supersymmetry, they found two things. First of all, it's a symmetry with, in a sense, fermionic generators. And they found that it was a nice way to extend Poincaré. So they went off and found representations and wrote down supersymmetric theories. Yes?
So these are representations of the group in the usual sense, or?
I'll get to that in a second.
Sorry?
I'll get to that in a second. Okay, so in the case of Poincaré, the representations of Poincaré depend on how many space-time dimensions you're working in. And the same goes for supersymmetry, so not surprisingly. I'm going to focus exclusively on representations of supersymmetry in four dimensions, but there's a whole lot of work on representations of supersymmetry in other dimensions. And the generators of supersymmetry are Weyl fermions. So you have left and right-handed Weyl fermions that I'll write as Q alpha and Q bar alpha dot. Actually, I'll write as a beta. So these are your usual Weyl fermions, the so-called 1/2 0 and 0 1/2 representations. And this label, so alpha and beta dot are the Lorentz, are the Weyl indices. The A and B correspond to what's called the number of supersymmetries. Okay, so in the case of Poincaré and for other symmetries you've looked at, the symmetries have typically corresponded to continuous so-called Lie groups. So a Lie group is a group whose elements can be parametrized by a set of coordinates, at least locally. And the idea of Lie groups is you look at a general group element parametrized by some coordinates, and you look at those coordinates near the origin, in a sense. So in other words, you take the unit element of the group that corresponds to the origin. You choose that to be, in a sense, the origin of your coordinate space, and you look at deviations away from that unit element. And the deviations around that unit element, you identify as so-called generators of the group. So if you recall that let's say I have a general group element. Suppose I have a general group element. So I'm going to step away from supersymmetry for a second. Suppose I have a general group element that I'll write as U of alpha A. So A is the set of coordinates I'm using to describe my Lie group, and U is a group element. We can choose our coordinates such that U of alpha A equals to 0 is the unit of the group. And I can usually also I can usually also write these general group elements as e to the minus alpha a ta. And if I expand around the unit element, at least sufficiently close to the unit element, I can write 1 minus I alpha ta dot 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 dot. And this form is nice because now instead of having an infinite number of group elements, I can reduce the process of finding representations for the group to the process of finding representations for these generators. And you can show that for a Lie group, the generators satisfy some TA, TB, has some structure constants, FAB, C, TC. There's some Jacobi identity, and so on and so forth. But this is the usual story for Lie groups. what we want to do here is generalize the idea of Lie groups to what are called Lie supergroups. So in the Lie group, all of our coordinates on the space are bosonic, in the sense that in this case, they're just regular coordinates. But I can generalize this idea to Grassmannian coordinates. So in other words, you've seen Grassmann numbers. And if I have a group where the parameters of the group can be labeled both by just regular coordinates as well as Grassmann value coordinates, that gives me something called a Lie supergroup. And in the Lie supergroup, I'll have generators that look something like alpha ATA, but I can also have generators that involve some set of Grassmann valued coordinates. That looks something like this. And what we're getting with supersymmetry, it turns out, is not just a Lie group, it's a Lie supergroup. So going back to this Coleman-Mandula theorem, implicitly they assumed they were looking at representations of regular Lie groups. They hadn't thought of Lie supergroups. A bit later, people came along and realized, oh, you have these Lie supergroups, let's look at them. And Lie supergroups have this set of coordinates, these set of so-called bosonic coordinates, and this set of fermionic coordinates. And for each fermionic coordinate, there's a corresponding fermionic generator, such that this whole thing is together, fermion-fermion gives me something that's bosonic that matches up, that I can sensibly add to that. So again, I realize I'm being very sketchy here, but this is roughly the idea. And the generalization is a Lie supergroup. And corresponding to the Lie algebra, for the Lie supergroup, instead of trying to represent each of the infinite number of supergroup elements, I only have to find representations for a set of generators for the so-called Lie superalgebra. So that's what we're going to do with supersymmetry. So supersymmetry turns out to be a Lie supergroup that extends Poincaré with fermionic coordinates. And we're going to want to find a representation for its Lie superalgebra. And before we do that, I have to write down the Lie superalgebra. So a Lie superalgebra typically has, when you have two fermions coming together, it's an anti-commutator instead of a commutator. And it turns out that the anti-commutator of Q with Q bar is essentially comes together to give you the momentum generator. The QQ anti-compute with each other. And when you have either a pair of bosonic generators, or bosonic plus fermionic, you combine them with a commutator. And then there are also some there's also a set of commutation relations between the Qs and, oh, I think I covered it up, but the Qs and the J mu nus that generate Lorentz boosts and rotations. Okay, so this is what I'm going to focus on for now. Oh, and then, sorry, I forgot the delta AB. So it turns out that this is the Lie superalgebra for supersymmetry. And you can take this, and just like you did for the Poincaré group, you can sit down and go off and try to find representations for it. Finding these representations is, in general, very non-trivial. And I'm not actually going to go through it. I'm essentially just going to quote the essential results. But what you're doing at the end of the day is completely analogous to what you do in the case of finding representations of the Poincaré group. You just have to be a little bit fancier in terms of what's going on. Now, one other thing I want to mention are that these generators you can think of them as operators on a Hilbert space. They're fermionic operators in the sense that they're Grassmann valued. So up to this quantum mechanical non-zero thing, you would expect these Grassmann valued things to anti-commute. It's when you put in the quantum mechanics that things either don't commute or don't anti-commute. In this case, not anti-commuting is a little bit like X and P not commuting in regular quantum mechanics. And then on the other hand, a Grassmann value, I classically can move a constant through a Grassmann number without any sign, and that's just what's reflected here. Okay, so here. This is the case of the Lie superalgebra for supersymmetry. And I've written it generally in the sense that instead of just one supersymmetry generator, I have n of them. I have these coordinates that run from 1 to n. And I'm going to focus specifically on the case of n equals 1 supersymmetry and d equals to 4. And there's an important phenomenological reason for that. And that is that we're going to want to put the standard model, embed the standard model into a supersymmetric theory. And it turns out that in four dimensions, if I have n larger than 1, my representations end up not having chiral fermions. I always get fermion partner pairs, and that doesn't match up with the standard model. So in terms of embedding the standard model, I want to stick to n equals to 1. Now, people often look at bigger supersymmetries, like n equals 2 or n equals 4. Typically, you don't want to go too high up in n, because the higher you go in n, the bigger your representations of supersymmetry become. And the bigger your representations become, the more particles with more spins you have. And it turns out that having particles with spin larger than 2 can be a serious problem for writing down a consistent quantum field theory. So people also typically don't look at n too large. So I won't say too much about larger n, but there is a whole industry of looking at supersymmetric field theories in all kinds of different dimensions, with all kinds of different n's, with all kinds of different representations. I'm going to focus on this particular case because this is the one that seems to be relevant for embedding the standard model. Okay, so for n equals to 1, I can essentially, my delta AB just becomes 1, and I don't need these A and B indices. So from now on, I'm just going to talk about Q alpha and Q bar beta dot. And this is going to simplify my life. Okay, so based on this result, plus this Coleman-Mandula or Hogg-Lopezansky and so on theorems, there are certain implications I can get right off the bat using these commutation relations and using this result. So one implication is that if I have any gauge or global symmetry generators, so we already had in the standard model, for example, or in typical field theories without supersymmetry, that your gauge and global symmetry generators commute with the momentum and the boost operators. But what we also find with supersymmetry is that they also have to commute with the supersymmetry generators, and this has an important implication. And that is that. So all members of a supermultiplet is the name I'm going to give to a given representation of supersymmetry plus Poincaré. So the first implication is that if I take some particle, I put it into a supermultiplet, its superpartners all have to have the same gauge charges. So for example, suppose I take an electron and I supersymmetrize it. So now I have an electron and possibly other particles that are related to it by supersymmetry. Those other particles have to have the same, for example, electric charge as the electron. Now, there's one slight exception to this. Called R symmetries, but I'm not going to say too much about this for the time being. But for the most part, at least for all the regular symmetries we all know and love, they're going to have to commute with supersymmetry. So everything that comes into a supermultiplet, all the elements of a supermultiplet, are going to have the same gauge charge. So this tells us that, for example, the superpartner of a given standard model particle will have to have essentially the same gauge properties as a standard model partner. The second implication is p squared . So p squared commutes with all the generators, both of Lorentz, both of Poincaré. You saw this already, but as well, but also supersymmetry. So that's just the supersymmetry part is just a trivial result from this. So if p commutes, p squared commutes. And you probably saw when talking about standard model or quantum field theory that p squared is used to organize representations, and p squared, if you like, corresponds to the mass of the representation. So since p squared commutes with everything, we can always choose. So p squared commutes with everything. We can always choose our representation to have fixed values of p squared, and thus let's organize things. And because p squared commutes with supersymmetry among the other generators, this implies that at least to the limit of exact supersymmetry, so the second result looks a little bit discouraging, because, for example, if we supersymmetrize the electron, we're going to have, first of all, a new particle with the same gauge charge, but also in the limit of exact supersymmetry, the other elements of the electron in the supermultiplet are also going to have the same mass. And we definitely don't see new particles with the same mass as the electron, so we're going to have to come back and fix this up, but let's not worry about this for the time being. The third result is the number of fermionic and bosonic degrees of freedom. Are equal. So I'll be more precise about this in a second, but one example we'll see is a very simple kind of multiplet that we'll use a lot is a so-called chiral multiplet, and it consists of a single complex scalar and a single vial fermion plus its superpartner. A single vial fermion plus its antiparticle. So the vial fermion plus antiparticle corresponds to a chiral fermion. That's 1 degree of freedom. It's antiparticle with the opposite helicity. That's a second degree of freedom. So that gives you two fermionic degrees of freedom, and those match up to the two bosonic degrees of freedom of a complex scalar. So you can think of it as the real and imaginary parts. So that's the third implication. And the fourth implication is that invariance under supersymmetry. So if I have a theory that's supersymmetric, if I apply this to if I apply this result and I sandwich it between the vacuum of the theory, what I get is for the theory to realize supersymmetry explicitly, supersymmetry should annihilate the vacuum. If it doesn't annihilate the vacuum, I have spontaneous symmetry breaking, but let's assume that it does. One implication of this is because Q alpha annihilates a vacuum, I can sandwich this operator between two vacuum states, and I'll get zero, guaranteed. But if I do the same thing on this side, first of all, P mu on the vacuum is a combination of P zero, and that's a Hamiltonian, and vector P, which is a spatial momentum. We know that the spatial momentum operator annihilates a vacuum. So what we're left with on this side is essentially the Hamiltonian sandwich between the vacuum. And it turns out that this implies that if I have exact supersymmetry invariance, this forces the vacuum expectation value of the Hamiltonian to be zero as well. And this is a neat result in the sense that we see that with exact supersymmetry, the vacuum energy of the vacuum has to be exactly zero. Normally in field theories, we have a freedom to move the vacuum energy up and down arbitrarily. You don't have that freedom in a limit of exact global supersymmetry. And this is actually kind of a suggestive feature, in that we know that the vacuum energy of the universe, the so-called cosmological constant, seems to be really, really small. And supersymmetry in this sense seems to help a little bit, in that we see a very small vacuum energy, and there could be some connection with supersymmetry here. Okay, so let me move this up. Okay, so the general form of supersymmetry transformations are, remember, RQ generators of supersymmetry are fermionic, so they're Grassmann-valued operators. And in general, we're going to have that Q acting on a bosonic state is going to give me a fermion state, and Q acting on a fermion state is going to give me a boson. If you look at the effects of supersymmetry on fields, it turns out that the supersymmetry transformation of a field phi, a general supersymmetry transformation, is going to have the form of something like the supersymmetry generator contracted with a Grassmann-valued transformation parameter. And if I transform by the transformation parameter C, the transformation of a scalar field is going to look something like the transformation parameter times a fermion. And the transformation, like C, of a fermion is going to look something like, again, schematically, C mu xi bar del mu phi. So in this sense, we see that our boson is transforming into a fermion, and our fermion is transforming into a boson. So I'm not actually going to say much about how to get representations of supersymmetry, and I'm not going to say very much about the actual form of these transformations. There are a lot of resources for that. Two places I'd recommend looking are the standard textbook. So the standard textbook on supersymmetry is called West and Bagger. If you look at West and Bagger, I suggest skipping the first, I think, two or so chapters, because they get a bit dense, and then it actually lightens up a fair bit after. But West and Bagger is a very nice book. And for a more kind of hands-on phenomenological review, there's a very nice review by Steve Martin. Not the comedian, but the physicist. Steve Martin, it's 1997. It has something like 2,000 citations. It's very popular. So if you search under Steve Martin, 1997, and lots of citations, you should be able to pull it up. And in both of these resources, they go through they go through the form of these transformations in a bit more detail, as well as the effect on fields. Okay, So I'm just about out of time. But I think you have everything. I think you have everything you need for the tutorials. I've posted a homework. The homework has some stuff involving supersymmetry, some stuff not involving supersymmetry. I think it's due in a week. The supersymmetry part of it that you'll need for the homework, I'll cover on Monday. So don't worry too much about that. But just to give you a quick idea of where we're going to go, I'm going to tell you about the two representations of supersymmetry we're going to look at and we're going to use for embedding the standard model in a supersymmetric theory. And the first representation of supersymmetry is called the chiral representation. And the chiral representation you can think of as consisting of a complex scalar, a Weyl fermion, and then a so-called auxiliary field that is going to turn out doesn't correspond to a particle. And in these chiral fields, in these chiral supermultiplets, when we get to the standard model, we're going to identify these components of chiral multiplets with standard model fermions. And that means that the standard model fermions are going to have complex scalar superpartners that we're going to call fermions. The other kind of multiplet we're going to look at is a so-called real or vector multiplet. And the form of a real or vector multiplet is something like this, where this is another Weyl fermion. This is a usual Lorentz vector field. And this is another so-called auxiliary field that is going to turn out not to correspond to any kind of physical particle. So for the so-called real or vector multiplet, when we get to the standard model, we're going to embed the standard model gauge bosons into these vector multiplets, which means that for every standard model gauge boson, there's going to be a fermionic superpartner. So in this case, the superpartner of the fermions is a boson. We're going to call them sfermions. And the superpartners of the gauge bosons are going to be Weyl fermions that we're going to call gauginos. Now, it turns out that we're also going to put the Higgs bosons into chiral multiplets. And for the embedding of the Higgs into chiral multiplets, we're going to identify this component with the Higgs. And that means that the Higgs is also going to have a fermionic superpartner called the Higgsino. So I'll get to that. I'll get to that on Monday, and I guess I'll wrap it up there. So I think you have another tutorial today. Your homework should be posted soon. And I'm going to have to leave after lunch, but you can track me down before then if you have questions. Or otherwise, I'll see you on Monday.